Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yes, Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast in which we review audiobooks, then come back for a thorough spoiling. Today we are reviewing Arkwright by Alan Steele. Barry, would you grace us with a reading of the back of the book, please?
Nathan Arkwright is a seminal author of the 20th century. At the end of his life, he becomes reclusive and cantankerous, refusing to appear before or interact with his legion of fans. Little did anyone know, Nathan was putting into motion his true, timeless legacy. Convinced that humanity cannot survive on Earth, his Arkwright Foundation dedicates itself to creating a colony on an Earth-like planet several light years distant. Fueled by Nathan's legacy, generations of Arkwrights are drawn together and pulled apart by the enormity of the task and weight of their name.
I'm a little confused by that last sentence, you know, the enormity of the task and the weight of their name. I mean, Arkwright is a pretty heavy name.
It does have a certain level of responsibility in this book.
It does. It does. Kevin, what did you think?
I really wanted to like this book a lot.
Okay, Barry, what did you think? No, just kidding.
It's dangerous.
Tell us your true feelings, Kevin.
Yes, it was okay. There was a long, slow, quasi-accurate history.
And that, gentle readers, actually constitutes a positive review from Kevin.
I think.
Positive-ish. I wouldn't say recommend it, but I wouldn't say it was horrible. So
it's incisive commentary like that that makes us one of the most popular podcasts out there.
I'm amazed we didn't win a Hugo.
I'm not entirely clear that we didn't.
Did we?
Barry, what did you think of this book?
I actually liked it quite a bit. It reminded me a bit of some of the planning from Seven Eves.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a lot of elements of, you know, other popular books out there. And I think it's a good how-to guide to, you know, possibly saving or not saving humanity in the future.
Which we certainly intend to do.
Yes.
Save or not save humanity.
Well, we could partially save it. I mean, we could always half-ass it, right?
Well, that's what the species does best now, isn't it?
Indeed.
Sorry, I've been reading the news recently.
Is that your problem?
Many.
Yes. Why don't you go read your Twitter feed for a couple minutes and come back and give us your review of the book?
Because I could not then be heard over the sobs. But I liked this book. Of course, it helped that I read it when coming back from Worldcon, where this book actually begins and, you know, a fair amount of it takes place in. So it was completely insane because I've actually talked to people at Worldcon about the first scene of this book, but that all really happened, more or less. There were two split groups of fans, and there was one group that wanted to... Well, anyway, I'll get back into that, into the discussion section. But, it's sort of an interesting, you know, Forrest Gump-style thing that... first of all, it's a family drama, was what they call this sort of thing, where... James A. Michener novels. I don't know if those were remotely popular these days or not, but I remember when I was growing up, then you would read this book about, these characters get together and, you know, have kids, and then this is what happens to the next generation and the next generation and the next generation. And I didn't like all of the generations equally in this book. In some ways, I liked the first part of the book where they are dealing with what we call first fandom, the original group of people that sort of got together and defined a lot of what we consider science fiction today. But it was sort of an interesting kind of rhapsody on what is the purpose of science fiction? What are we trying to do with this? Does it have a point, or is it just entertainment? And that's all sort of subtext, but it's kind of trying to think about a situation where you could take science fiction and turn it into reality. So I wound up really liking it, although there are a few segments that are a little bit drawn out. Okay. All right. Well, it's time for us to embark on the multi-generational journey that is our discussion section. And it'll just seem like you've started listening to it and your children now have to listen to it.
And now your grandchildren are forced into this, you know.
Don't worry. There's a little boy named Sanjay that's asleep at the end of this podcast.
All hail Sanjay.
Okay. We shall return, for we are sci-fi.
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 And welcome back to our discussion section, where we shall spoil, actually, probably the next several generations of human existence.
It's not a surprise.
It rarely is. So did we have any favorite scenes that we had wanted to talk about?
I guess I kind of like the scene where, towards the end, you know, the Earth is going to be destroyed by an asteroid. Oh, that's my favorite scene. No. But that during that part, they were like, hey, we're going to save everybody by sending our asteroid mining ships. And then they're like, huh, that's not really going to work probably. and then someone's like, hey, we could just use your drive system your beam system that you use to accelerate the ship. And we can reuse that to, you know, punch a hole in the asteroid or whatever.
Can't have any government funding.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it reminded me of that one project where somebody was trying to bring a satellite back that a bunch of open source software guys and, you know, so forth just got together at an abandoned McDonald's at Moffett Field and were trying to bring this one satellite back to life.
Did they consider a very long stick with a magnet on the end?
To hit us with personally? Quite possibly.
No, to catch the satellite as it went by.
Quick. Are you actually expecting an answer? You're actually looking at me as though there's some sort of answer to that inane bundle of words that you're calling a question.
Well, it could be as simple as no.
I've tried saying no to you many times. It has no real effect.
I don't like where that's going.
Anyway, yes. Okay, yes, good scene. Kevin, did you have anything else to say about it?
That scene? Well, as far as good things, that part was good. But and actually, that was one of the parts that I liked about the book was sort of the
good parts.
Yes, the good parts. Good parts are good. Just that they... Those are things that I liked, because it's like, oh, maybe one day we might do something useful like that in real life. Mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of faith at this point, but maybe eventually we'll do something useful and not let the human race be destroyed eventually. But, you know, I don't have a lot of faith in that. So
win-win.
Please donate to the Barry Foundation.
What is the Barry Foundation donate to?
Myself.
I thought so. Is this the Save the Human Foundation?
Yes.
Save the Human.
With you being the human.
Yes.
Okay.
I am a plump pink ape.
Thank you, visual.
Great. Well, let's see. So I really liked the opening sections quite a bit, which I've got to say, like I said earlier, a lot of people will find that pretty tedious, because it's about a science fiction writer who is finding his way among science fiction fandom. And I've got to admit, maybe normally I wouldn't find that quite so fascinating, but reading it coming home from Worldcon with some of the people that are in that scene or actually attending the convention.
There is a lot of name dropping in that segment of the book.
Right, exactly. And that's rather deliberate, but that's kind of a famous scene in the history of fandom, because fandom kind of started with a squabble as to what is science fiction for? What's it all about? Should we be, you know, political? And, you know, a lot of futurism and so a lot of that stuff actually comes out of, you know, communist architecture styles and that kind of crazy stuff. And so, of course, a lot of science fiction writers just wanted to write books about spaceships and robots, thank you very much, and ray guns, lots of ray guns.
Like Planet of Adventure.
Well, Planet of Adventure, exactly.
Well, it does remind me a bit of the, you know, the sad puppies and the angry puppies or whatever.
It's actually not a debate we have completely managed to slough off at all. It still persists to this day. There's also been similar debates going on within atheist and skeptic communities and pretty much anything where You know, I'm quite sure that there's somebody who's saying, no, we should be using My Little Pony for the betterment of mankind.
Isn't that what it's for?
No.
It's just entertainment.
Sometimes ponies should just be ponies, damn it.
What about Smurfs?
The Smurfs are actually bent on world destruction. I don't think there's any real debate about that. I don't understand.
Gargamel's just trying to save the world.
Oh, right. I mean, you know, they'll, you know, if they only think of how many Smurfs there were and just one woman.
Gargamel is the Christ figure. Weird.
Although we already did accuse the Smurfs of being, what is it?
I've accused them of many things. You're going to have to refresh my memory. Be specific.
Of being, let's see, the Norse gods.
Oh, right. Oh,
yes.
That was pretty awesome.
Smurfette is Freya. All of her hair was removed by Loki.
Anyway, yes. Where are we?
My house.
I don't mean in my narrative. I'm just experiencing free-floating blah. But,
Ringtone.
So, yes, I thought that the opening segment where they are sort of meeting all of the stalwarts and, you know, early figures from the beginning of science fiction, that was really fascinating. And it really seemed to me like they were that these were kind of rewritten versions of people that, you know, existed and fit into that space, but I couldn't figure out who they were sort of portraits of. So it seemed to me like they had written them very well into the scene, to the point where it seemed like they fit.
Well, it was interesting that, you know, at first I was like, is this like a parallel, you know, universe where like Star Trek didn't happen or something, and this was supposed to be Star Trek, but then they mentioned Star Trek, so it seemed to be our universe, but this was sort of an addition or something.
Is this considered an alternate history science fiction book?
Well, yeah, I suppose, because... But not very much alternate history. I mean, you know.
Because only the future stuff hasn't happened yet and it happened differently.
Right.
Huh? Well, I mean, he does reference, like, you know, his stuff is the Galaxy Patrol. And then he references...
E. Doc Smith's Galactic Patrol. And so it seems like he's sort of a slightly modified version of Doc Smith.
Right. Although he says, you know, Doc Smith exists, and he even says, well, I didn't invent it. I just sort of did a little better than he did or something. So,
right.
It was kind of like someone that didn't exist kind of inserted in between the pages of history or something.
Right. I mean, you know, it's a lot like, say, Jack Williamson or...
Who they mention.
Right, exactly. I mean, they mentioned everybody.
Yeah, they basically... And at that first part of the book, I was kind of trying to figure out, well, what kind of book is this? You know, there's a lot of... Is it like a history of science fiction stuff? And
right. I wasn't entirely convinced that this was going to be an actual science fiction novel. I was just like, oh, maybe it's just a novel about science fiction. And I was actually prepared to sort of set in and enjoy that.
What's even funnier is how I ended up picking this book, which was I was doing some research on arcologies, thanks to Kevin, and I was looking for some books with some arcologies in them, and this one ended up on the list, which it does not have.
There is not an arcology in here, as far as I could tell.
What do you guys mean by arcology? You mean generationship?
No, it's a portmanteau of
architect and ology.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a sort of like self-contained, self-sufficient building.
Ah.
And I was actually suggesting that Google build their own, and then we could unhook it from the grid when we finally don't need them and let it float off.
The Apple Spaceship Campus is sort of like the eco version of an arcology. It's, I mean, they kind of had them in Margaret Atwood's stuff, right? You know.
Well, I mean, you know, you mean like Biodome 2 or
kind of like that.
Biodome is actually a version of an arcology where it's
one of the original heads of Biodome 2 is recently unemployed again.
No, he's got a job. He's back at his old job.
Okay, good.
I wish him the best of luck.
I mean, so that early history part was. Kind of disjoint, but it was interesting enough. Although it didn't give enough context if you didn't know the history already, I guess.
that is sort of like I say, I'm not an independent interviewer on this one.
Right. And then I thought the part that dragged, I mean, that part was sort of interesting, although kind of like, huh? And then, but the part that dragged more was the part where they had the, you know, the daughter who had the different mother than she thought she did.
Right.
And they kind of like really dragged this, like, well, I could tell you, but why don't you talk to this other old guy about it? And it's like, seriously, it's like, it's like an 2 hours of this. And like, and I thought, I mean, that, I mean, technically the first two thirds and maybe, well, maybe the first like one third of the book could be condensed too. And then they decided to build a spaceship or something. But
I look forward to reading Kevin's novel called They Made the Spaceship and It Went.
We are strong.
I mean, I'm being a little brutal, but you know, it, there were so many parts that I was like, they seem to really be going out of their way to irritate me on this. And obviously, since everything is written for me personally, I was, you know, irritated. Yes.
However, if they'd been describing exactly how they built the spaceship with nuts and bolts, you'd have been wrapped. Yeah,
I would have been like, this is awesome. What is it, a 5/16? What's the, what's the threat?
Was there a 35-minute, talk about whether they decided to use metric or...
Well, so for example, one of the things that I thought was the most inane, like, what, like, is, so they're down on the launch site, you know, in the future, they're building this thing and they need to get like another piece of the, their next rocket launched so that they could assemble it in space.
Right.
And by this time there's, you know, there was some, whatever it was, you know, the Christian group that was down there boycotting because sending people to other planets is against, you know, God's will, they say.
Sure.
And so they're like, well, before we just landed it right here, but because of some weather timing, la, 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 we have to, you know, fly it down to this other section and we're going to have to like, you know, drive the spaceship through town to the launch site. And then someone, you know, the character just sort of, you know, mentions, well, maybe we should have people walk alongside it, you know, for security. And they're like, why would we need that? And you're like, you've been launching spaceships for this long and you just didn't occur to you maybe just to get some security guards. And,
but they also had security
guards. Yeah, they did, but it was sort of like they weren't taking it very seriously.
And that's because it's the future. It's non, it's less violent.
Yeah, I guess.
Except for the violence.
I don't know. It just kind of was this whole thing of like, it's like, well, sure, we just kind of sort of plan it half-assed and let our random people off the side, you know, because it was just the guy's son, right, or something. He wasn't even really officially, he kind of got pushed into the role because he was a deadbeat. And I don't know. That whole like, generation was one of my less favorite generations because then, you know, he ends up marrying that woman who was a very strong character until she gets, you know, hit by that explosion. Right. And then later on, she basically like, they get married, go back to, you know, the mountaintop or whatever. And, you know, are taking care of this, you know, this, the further Arkwright adventures. And he, you know, the guy becomes a drunkard and leaves the family, and that like completely destroys her for the next 20 years. And
I'll, right.
And then he comes back, you know, to save the day from the asteroid. And suddenly like 2 weeks later, she's fine again. I'm like, oh, wow. She's not a very strong character now, is she? It's like, you know, until your deadbeat husband comes back 20 years later and now you're fine again.
Then the man returned.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. I was
it's
like,
what she really needed the whole time.
Yeah.
That was sarcasm, ladies and gentlemen. Sarcasm. Irony.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. I was like, wow. That, yeah.
So I think my favorite scene, which was actually pretty shortened considering the overall length of the book and was absolutely required to have the ending of the book, was when he sort of sits his daughter on his lap and she sends that little recording to Sanjay. I don't know. That would... For me, it was just sort of like a nice little, you know, 5 or 10 minute thing where, you know, it's like, well, you know, you got to practice because it can't be too long and we're going to compress it. So, you know, you really should, you know, practice this a few times. And then when it comes time to do it, he's like, oh, you know, this, you know, someone else is there and I'm not supposed to be doing this. So, you know, I'm going to go distract him for a moment and you're going to go record it.
Right. I mean, this was a thing where he tells his young daughter that, you know, on the ship, there's a little boy that's living there basically, but right. Nobody knows about it except her. So she sort of imagines, you know, him living on the ship. And for, you know, she believed that he was really there for a long time until she got older. And so, yeah, she sent this message out.
Right. And then it later turns out that he reprogrammed the computer to make Sanjay one of the names on the ship so that it would be retroactively considered true.
So it's sort of like a meta metcon, a retcon, meta retcon
in an alternate history book.
Exactly.
Alternate history science fiction book, even.
Alternate future. Wait, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, so that's what I was saying is I was trying to figure out, you know, I'm not sure if the book was wrestling with what kind of book it was, or maybe I was just trying to wrestle with what kind of book it was, because there were parts where it's like, and then they had a quantum computer, you know, which they didn't ever talk about other than that sort of made the computer super awesome.
And I thought that's what that meant.
Yeah, well, that's what I was saying. Like, it would have made sense if this was supposed to be like a 1930s or 40s science fiction book, right? Because then it's like, it's supercomputer. It's a, you know, an awesome robot or whatever.
Yeah, that's what I think this book is actually about. I think this book is about science fiction. That's why it spends so much time in the beginnings of science fiction, and why it's, and in some ways, it's kind of going through some of the different phases that science fiction has gone through, where, you know, it gets very preoccupied with relationships and so on. And
so maybe, you know, I can appreciate it more on a sort of a meta level if it's like really was trying to go through like different science fiction tropes over the years, kind of a history going into the tropes, and then also...
I may be giving it a little too much credit on that, but I think you can read it that way. We'll put it that way.
I'd be willing to interpret it that way, in which case I'll add another star.
Yeah, I think it's sort of a subtle, you know, backstory to it or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the book really, you know, within the book, it seems like it starts around like the late 40s or something and sort of moves forward from there until we get to the stars.
Right.
And unleash our quadruped selves.
Yeah.
But yeah, to me, it's sort of like it's interrogating the idea of science fiction, because originally science fiction was very forward thinking and very forward looking. And there was sort of this idea that, oh, okay, we will wind up in the stars. And now there's a certain disillusionment. I mean, it no longer seems like we're going to naturally wind up doing this.
That costs money, Steve.
Exactly.
We have stuff to do here.
Are we unnaturally end up there?
You know, there's some terrible jokes I could make.
But that's why you should support me as dictator, because I'd make sure we'd go to the stars soon.
Kevin, I would support you absolutely as dictator. I'm not entirely sure what your orders would be, and neither would anybody else.
We build something. Would you build something?
A thing.
To space. Like an elevator and stuff, also stars and spaceships and things.
I was actually thinking it'd be like a giant springboard. And
that would
stand
be awesome.
On it, you would be launched into orbit.
I would say that they should do the, what was it, from Earth to the Moon or whatever, where like they dig the big shaft all the way down to launch the rocket capsule from there. You know, the H.G. Wells one.
Yes, I'm mostly imagining the movie version where they just like, oh, the Earth, we go from the Earth to the Moon. Just wave flags and then the thing winds up in the man in the moon's eye.
Is this where I dive the ship down through the planet as it's exploding?
Yeah, well, I mean, it did get into sort of like the depressing realism of, hey, you know, we have all this money and we've gotten it this far. You know, we've launched this ship because of basically this billionaire. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh, wait, we ran out of money and now we want some funding. And then someone decided to, you know, make it their pet project to destroy it because nothing else to do. And
right. This guy that was very obviously based on Senator William Proxmire, who would just occasionally, whenever he could, would slash. Oh, he had this. Proxmire was, he was actually a verb back in the day. Oh no, our project has been proxmired.
I have never heard this before.
Oh yeah. No, he had what he called the Golden Fleece Award, where he thought that, you know, money was being spent on things like hopes and dreams rather than, you know, his state.
are you talking about now?
No,
this was, we're trying to actively smash hopes and dreams, and
it's already done.
No, this was back when you could actually identify people that were bad.
Oh, everyone's bad now.
I'm pretty sure I know who's bad.
Everybody but you.
You know
and
it?
Possibly you guys.
Wow. That's the nicest thing I've heard all day.
I have determined that you both are not Nazis.
That is correct in my case.
I am also not a Nazi.
So... Anyway, yeah. So the thing that was a little bit jarring was, you know, this felt kind of like the cut in Seven Eves at the end, where it's suddenly like, and now book three, the bronies are on the planet doing their things as.
But at least they weren't taking public transit a very, very long way.
Yes, I got on the bus. It was several weeks later. I got to work.
Yeah, I mean, it was the end wasn't bad. You know, I was just sort of.
Well,
making a reference, but it was kind of a first.
They seem to swim quite well for quadrupeds.
Well, yeah, they were actually amphibious.
I must have missed that bit.
They just,
I mean, I knew they spent a lot of time in the water.
Right. They mentioned at the end, oh, and we made you amphibious. And I was just like, oh, I must have missed that. Because now they also have boats, but they did go diving. And I just wasn't paying attention to the fact that they were just staying down there a really long time.
And having very quiet, intimate conversations while swimming together.
Yes. Something like that, yes. But the one thing that I really wished we had was the description of how the children were actually raised initially, because they had the teacher.
Yeah.
But it seemed like, you know, I remember I've read about this kind of project in the past, what, you know, in books for kids about, oh, we could send these robot ships out with human sperm and eggs and just have the kids raised by robots. And it's just like, okay, we skipped a very important part there. So
don't you know we just send David, like, you know, in, you know, Alien Covenant?
Well, you know, that was an episode of Blake 7 called Deliverance.
Oh, God, we're there.
Yes, we're there. Ding, 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 where they ding, ding. Have a rocket ship and that's going to go out to a distant star and, you know,
sure do
genetic
have a
material.
Rocket ship.
Yes.
Is it shaped like a banjo?
Anyway, you may continue.
I may. One and never knows.
And it features Tom Selleck as David, robot.
The thing that surprised me was that they only sent two robots down.
Right.
You think they'd have, like, you know, at least three or four.
Well, it's one of those things where, okay, if you can raise humans with robots, if they're not fully human, wouldn't that kind of stunt the kids a little bit? It's kind of hard to imagine that. And then if they have these amazing AIs, why do they need the humans?
So,
I mean,
so I'm imagining, you know, like the Channel 9 nature show where, you know, they don't want to get, you know, abandoned critters, you know, too used to humans. So they wear like masks or, you know, things to feed them. So there's this robot wearing like this sort of human, you know, stretchy face mask.
Oh, God.
And it's all,
it's a fembot.
Oh, this mask is getting bad. I need a new one. I'd like a volunteer from the audience.
Eat your gruel, boy.
Wow. This sounds more like that 23 boy.
Yes. Yes, indeed. I am human.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of thing that I think sounds like an awesome project, but it's a little more disturbing the way it's described here.
Well, I mean, I just didn't like how that part was hand-waved, but then again, I can't really argue with the fact that, well, maybe we just don't know, and it's kind of hard to come up with an interesting approach of, oh, and then we raised all these kids.
Yeah, I think it could have been an interesting, I mean, it was sort of like the, you know, well, they talked about in Brave New World, so we can just skip that part, like, right? You know,
so this is also the thing with, you know, Interstellar, where they basically sent a bunch of, you know, sperm and eggs out, and they had a couple of people, but they used a wormhole to get where they're going faster. So maybe they were smarter. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, they actually did mention wormholes, like, in the beginning when they were talking about how could you write science fiction stories without actually breaking the laws of physics,
right? And you've heard of Einstein-Rosen bridges, right? No.
And that's one of the things that I do have a certain tick about is, you know, we in science fiction, you know, pride ourselves about, well, we don't use magic in our rigidly science fiction story.
We use Mr. Fusion.
Jump to hyperspace. We use Warp 9.
Right.
None of which makes any actual sense.
Hey, that's not true. I saw a YouTube video where they talked about it. Apparently, there has been two or three scientists that kind of said, well, there was some guy that you know, posited you could do a warp drive, but it would take, like, you know, the amount of energy in the universe, like, compressed into this, like, you know, Big Bang size thing. And
Michio Kaku, brilliant physicist who made the discovery that if you tell people what they want to hear, they will put you on television.
Yes.
So actually, I have nothing against Michio Kaku. Please show up on our show.
We'll interview you for sure.
So we won't even charge you for it.
To pull it back to more reality, right? I mean, you know, in a lot of books, they sort of speculate about like this ion engine, right?
Right.
Which is turns out to be, we're actually making one right now. Mm-hmm. They do seem to function at some level.
Right.
And we do think that it will be feasible to do, you know, some sort of space travel with it. So, I mean, that's sort of like, I think that's kind of what this book is getting at, right?
Yes.
You know, we really should be leveraging, you know, science fiction to, you know, we pull the fiction out and make it real science.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right. And they do kind of say, you know, at one point, you know, yes, we could be building spaceships right now if we only weren't totally a crappy species that have no vision, basically.
And at Worldcon, we actually had an astronaut there. Tremendously nice guy. Really kind of stood out from the rest of us because he looked like he actually worked out in a gym every once in a while.
He was actually healthy.
Yes, exactly. And he was also wearing a spacesuit, but that actually didn't really make him stand out from the rest of the crowd very much.
There was also a bear in a spacesuit, right?
That was the mascot, yes.
So, yes.
Okay, yes.
There was a bear in a spacesuit at Worldcon.
I mean, it...
Was it Adam Savage or...?
Adam Savage was not officially there. One never knows if Adam Savage was actually at your convention, but he was never officially.
Well, yes,
at the convention.
He did wear a bear costume to another Comic-Con, I guess.
That's important, and we should talk about it. But now, where was I? Oh, yes, but he did credit science fiction with sort of inspiring him to move forward, and you know, said that you know the engineers behind this were inspired by science fiction. And it was a very moving speech. And I remember sitting there sort of saying, yeah, you know your audience, but maybe you're overstating the case a little bit. I mean, we'd all love to believe that it was science fiction that really spurs things forward. But maybe these people were also inspired by the fact that it was in their list of things they had to do to get this ship into orbit now.
I would like to thank all the scientists for the zero-G toilet.
Yes, you've got one in your back room. It's really disturbing.
What's your problem?
That you keep trying to use it, but that's another story.
It's zero G. You can do it
anywhere.
Yeah. It's mounted on the ceiling. Yes.
Hey guys, watch this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really great way to prototype things that are not feasible at all, apparently, or maybe even partly feasible. And then in the future, you know, whether people are inspired by just that or not, they kind of figure out, oh, we do have technology that can do something like this or, you know, something towards this direction. And eventually you kind of get there. And, you know, yes, we apparently did go to the moon, some people claim. And
hey, there's also a claim there was an eclipse yesterday, but you needed special glasses that only they approved of to see it. So,
oh, yeah, the glasses were great. They revealed that everybody is actually skulls and all the signs say obey.
Yes.
And like I said, part of what this book is about, I think, is interrogating and going back to the original vision of science fiction. I mean, it was called scientifiction back in the day. And I mean, it was sort of a, you know, a literature of engineers. It was kind of, oh, well, we've just heard about this new interesting thing. Let's talk about, you know, the implications of this in terms of, well, could we fly in a spaceship based on this? And, you know, half the time it's just fiction with, you know, you slap a veneer of science over it. But, you
right.
know, and of course, there's some science fiction that continues to be what we call hard science fiction, a little bit based on that. You know, Seven Eves is sort of a good example, and then some of the things we've read very much drift from that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this book was a great sort of melding between, like, you know, A Long Way to a Small Angry Planet and Seven Eves to me.
Yeah,
I mean, in terms of just its tone and, you know, the levels of science and levels of, you know, the interpersonal relationships that were sort of going on in the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it's actually one of the reasons why I feel like I enjoyed it quite a bit.
I mean, I expected more bad things to happen with the mission. The mission seemed very foolproof once it was launched, and that may be really more an expectation of literature more than an expectation of reality.
Yeah, there was like that one small problem where, you know, something was cut and it had to fix it. And then they were out of contact for several years or something. And
right. And it was like 5 minutes from its perspective, oh, but yeah. It was going along relativistic super fast.
I mean, that was literally like the scene out of 2001, right? You know, where they had to get out and they had to repair the space antenna, right? Which is what they were really repairing.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Right. I didn't think about it was that way.
Nanobots rather than Dave Bowman.
Right. And the nanobots got back in.
Right. And it turned out that the problem...
I'm sorry, nanobots. I'm afraid I can't do that. I mean, I guess the parts that I really liked were the parts that seemed like we could do this if we wanted to. Like the whole, the beam ship where it's like, you know, you can have something on Earth or in space that, you know, more likely that projects an energy beam out and then there's a sail that receives it that you're essentially pushing your energy out from here instead of there and you don't have to carry it with you. And, you know, it's, there's been proposals like that. So it's like stuff like that. You're like, just freaking do it already.
But we lack the, you know, political will plus the, you know, social.
Yeah. It's just very depressing.
Awareness to get past our own little selves.
Right. So that's why the Sci-Fi Foundation.
Exactly.
Formed on the amazing returns from this podcast will be used to send a ship into space. By ship, I mean
small DNA samples.
Glass of wine and space being my mouth.
Well, I think we'd start with AI. So I'm a proponent of, like, you know, early robotic exploration before you do man exploration. Right. You know, eventually they do man exploration unless you just have robot AIs. But
are we going to send like an evil AI, or is it going to be one of the good ones that Elon Musk wants to?
I mean, I think that we should really have a debate about this because I'm all in favor of sending the evil AIs. They
yeah,
just
I know.
Seem more effective.
Because it just delays like Rocco's Basilisk.
Exactly. I know Musk was suggesting that we put a ban on like the Ed 209 and stuff. And I'm like, whatever. Let's just do it.
Dude, that is our future. I mean, it's almost here already.
I mean, no, we should put a ban on Ed 209 because that sucker couldn't walk upstairs.
You're right.
But it's highly effective in the plane areas.
It wasn't very good at noticing whether it should turn on or off.
Right, exactly.
But it did sound like a line, so it was kind of scary. Hey.
I've done demos just about as bad as the one with Ed 209 in the beginning.
Except nobody got shot at the end.
Just remember, RoboCop.
Well, you weren't there for that one.
RoboCop, the hero of the movie, shot a man in the groin.
Well, I guess that shows us what we have to do. Anyway, moving ahead.
Bang.
Was there tea? Apparently there was.
Yes.
In passing.
Yes. And who would we want to be in this book?
I want to be the sort of the guy who is sort of the layabout and gets forced into the job.
That's pretty accurate so far. So.
So you want to be an alcoholic who lives for years upon years with the guilt of having messed with his family?
Yeah, I'll eventually die and I'll never remember. So,
well, that's true for everybody.
So you don't know for sure.
What's the downside?
At the end, you go and become a robot.
We at Sci-Fi appear to have just embraced the cool, cool grip of nihilism.
Eat more Arby's. That's a shout out to the Nihilist Arby's Twitter feed.
Yes. And also a fully paid ad. No, no, it is not. But maybe it will be.
But we do eat at Arby's on occasion.
We do. And sometimes at Wiener Schnitzel. That's more like a mind virus we plant on each other.
The real quote trifecta is if you could hit both in the same day.
I think that might kill you.
Challenge accepted.
Yeah.
If I die this week, you'll know why. It'll be your fault.
Happy as all of this is. I think that if I could be anybody, I would be a fly on the wall at that first convention because, I mean, I'm involved in science fiction conventions. It always just seems like you're kind of putting your head down and hoping it'll all go away.
Like, please, nothing bad happen. Please, nothing bad happen.
Exactly.
Call the cops. I guess they probably don't do that too much anymore.
But. Exactly. And I mean, it's nice to know that it wasn't that things started out with amazing, you know, unity and then
it's always been
fan drama has always been with us.
Yes, it's a people thing.
But yes, I would, I guess, like to be among the 1950s, even though
that's what I would be, a robot.
Well, okay, is that really your choice?
I don't know, being
the teacher sounds kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think most of the people were not very desirable in their characters. So yeah, it's kind of hard to choose from any of the main characters. I guess the robot would be one of the less horrible ones. I guess being the rich writer wouldn't be too bad, but he didn't seem to have a very like happy life though, so I don't know.
He could be Sanjay.
Yeah, I don't know that I want to be, you know, one of the bronies or whatever.
Kevin seems to have decided these are horse people at the end.
Well, my brain kept inserting hoof, even though they didn't say it. I was like, no, it's not necessarily that. It could be more like large orangutans or something like that. Like, and like,
so just to explain a little bit. So the colonists that they cloned and bred for this far off planet, they genetically engineered them for higher gravity, and so they were designed to walk on all fours, and Kevin seemed to believe that they were My Little Pony.
Well, yeah, I kind of thought that they did that not for shock value, but just like, oh, look, they could do something like really radical like this to, you know, as an example, rather than like, because it wasn't like, oh, it was three times gravity or something. It was like only like 30 or 50% more, which kind of seemed like, well, in the culture, they just made your bones thicker. So couldn't they have done that?
In the culture, you're just being held up by drones the whole time.
Yes.
I actually imagine them more as like otters or something. Like otter people.
Right. They did mention that they were amphibious.
Yeah, I didn't get a good, I probably could go back and listen to the descriptions because I didn't really get a good visual, but at one point I realized, oh, okay, so some, they could stand up on their hinds, as they would say, and fours instead of, you know, hind and forelegs, but yeah, so it sounded like they could do either depending on the situation. So I don't know. I didn't get a good visual there.
I like how Kevin looked at me and not you for that one.
Some people call it a sling blade. Okay. That's where we are. All right. So I think that's about it. Is there anything else we wanted to talk about? Seeing nothing. All right. Well,
aren't you going to talk about how awesome Worldcon was?
Oh, okay. Well, I did mention that I had just gotten back from Worldcon. Worldcon was a lot of fun. My wife was involved in running the masquerade, so I wound up just coming to see how she was doing, and she said, okay, could you go get this printout from upstairs? I got the printout. Okay, now could you read it into this microphone? Because you're now going to be the voice of God announcer at the beginning. I'm just like, okay. Similarly, I did go to the Hugo Awards. I was there to pick up an award for a friend of mine just in case he won. He did not, which is bad for him, but means I didn't have to get up and give a speech. So works for me.
That's a nice Hugo statue you got there, Steve.
Don't mention that.
Beep.
But yeah, so it was a really interesting convention. It was in Helsinki, Finland. I love the Finns. They're antisocial, computer obsessed, and they drink heavily. These are my people. Overall, let's see, my other bizarre little contribution was I walked into the press office and somebody was having some problems with producing a segment of video there. So I actually helped produce the in memoriam segment, and so I had to avoid like cheering wildly at the end when the whole thing played correctly. Just like, yay,
it worked.
They're all dead. No, sorry,
that's not what I meant. Honest,
kill the infidel. And but I did get to meet Ada Palmer, among other people that books we've reviewed in the past. And I would like to point out that I've always liked her books. I did mention, I've read your books, and I'll prove it by saying J.E.D.D. Mason. And she sort of smiled and nodded and didn't really react very much. But she was kind of having a quite an intense night for a bunch of reasons. She was up for the Campbell Award, which she actually won.
And, yeah, that was cool.
And she actually did a... And her singing group Sassafras actually sang for the mid break for the masquerade and did a fantastic job. So
it's like sort of Viking based a cappella.
They do a lot of Renaissance and different stuff, and they've had this whole Viking thing that they wanted to do. And so we thought it was perfectly appropriate for them to sing before a Finnish audience. And when I heard about that, I'm just like, I really hope they're really good then, because otherwise it's just like, and no, this Finnish group will sing American cowboy songs.
Yeah, no, I listened to some of it and I liked it.
Yeah, no, it's really good. And then of course the judging took longer than was originally expected. So they ran through all of their, all of their plan material.
Like, do some more.
And it's just like, nobody's talking to us, so we'll keep going. And it's, okay, we do this song at Renaissance fairs. And they were just sort of, I could tell that they were sort of just about getting to the edge of what they can do comfortably. And they were just about
practice this for a while.
Going to serious tracks.
You need the hook to pull us off stage.
Right. I was about to run backstage and see if I could hurry this along or at least get something going on. And then then my wife walked out on stage. So everything was fine. So overall, it was a really interesting experience. We're going to get an even more up close and personal view of it when Worldcon comes to San Jose, which is right next to us.
It's going to be great because we'll be accepting an award there for the best podcast.
I really hope we actually get nominated, but
seems unlikely.
That's up to you.
Use your brain powers to actualize it, Steven.
That's how it works, right?
It into being.
We just didn't want it enough. It's the people that really want it that get things.
Yeah.
Blame the victims.
Blame the winners.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see. So I can see that the spaceship is slowing down and all of these small children are about to be raised in some mysterious way by robots. So it's time for us to call into the podcast because we've been sleeping this entire time. Time to wake Sanjay.
I'm going to retroactively name him Barry.
Sanjay and Barry are the same name. All right, we shall return, for we are sci-fi.
Sci-fi.
Sci-fi.